Hi, and welcome to Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. I'm Jeremy Wartzman.
I'm Bianca Bremham.
And I'm Lara Chan Baker.
Jackie Winter Gives You the Business is a weekly podcast from the Jackie Winter Group, which is a creative production and representation studio based in Melbourne and New York City. What originally started as a business conference for artists and fellow creatives is now being turned around to shine a light on our clients. From art buyers and creative teams to fellow producers and managers, this podcast is all about offering a glimpse into the work we do as the bridge between clients and creatives. It's an ongoing exploration of how to wrangle the creative process to achieve excellence no matter what the medium. Today, we're getting into show business. Continuing our interview series, we chat with the illustrious Brendan Campbell about his 30 years in film and TV and the lessons he's learned from managing productions of that scale. But before we dive in, Lara and Bianca, how are you guys?
I'm super well. I am actually melting. How are you, Jeremy? How are you, Bianca?
The thing that immediately came into my mind was, Jeremy, you telling me that you had a Slurpee for breakfast on the way.
Yes. You had a Slurpee for breakfast?
Not for breakfast. Well, it was a Slurpee zilched, and which is my favorite.
Like, that makes it better.
It does make it better. There's no sugar. It's like, you know, around like 40 calories. I'm doing this like weird fasting thing where I'm not eating for 16 hours a day.
Are you being paid by Slurpee?
Look, I will not confirm or deny we actually have done all the Slurpee work for the last kind of 2 years.
That's so our turn.
I like to
advertising
support.
Does work. I mean, I started drinking Coca-Cola again after I saw Stuart McLaughlin's beautiful like vintage Christmas Coca-Cola poster illustration many years ago. it works.
Oh, God, we hope so. So starting off like we like to do every week, some of the links that have been circulating in our professional development Slack. This is one from TechCrunch that we're starting off with, which is all about, I guess, a new company. Is it a new company? United Masters? Tell us about this.
Startup. So I think this came up on my Twitter feed, and it's TechCrunch, and the title is, with $70 million from Alphabet, United Masters replaces record labels. Basically is the founder, well, one of the former presidents of Interscope Records, which I think is one of the biggest record labels in the world, secretly raised $70 million led by Google's corporate umbrella Alphabet to launch a new service called United Masters. And they're kind of saying, you know, like, record labels, are they obsolete now? Have they kept up with the music industry as it's evolved from kind of like selling CDs to now streaming songs and being able to promote artists through concert tickets and merchandise? And so United Masters aims to give musicians an alternative to what I think a lot of the record industry are kind of like, you know, like I was actually watching an interview with Billy Corgan of Smashing Pumpkins the other night, who commented that less than 10% of musicians that sign with a major label are actually successful. And the traditional record label model is maybe setting young artists and musicians up for failure, especially in this climate. So what United Masters is doing is actually taking kind of like the allowing musicians to get their work out into the world. So, you know, the artist will pay a small fee to distribute their music across the internet from Spotify to YouTube to SoundCloud, and perhaps giving them a better royalty split, but also kind of using like data and analytics to actually identify the listeners and allow artists to directly engage with their audience, as opposed to leaving that to the hands of a record label. So this is kind of, I think I wanted to talk about this because it's an interesting sort of, you know, it touches on something that we've talked about on the podcast before, about how, you know, in 2017, like, it's easy as an artist, whether you're a fine artist or a commercial illustrator, it's getting more and more, it's more and more commonplace to be able to easily promote your own work on social media and like actually, you know, have a direct audience. You know, do fine artists need gallery representation? Do commercial illustrators need an agent? Do musicians need a record label in order to actually be successful in this market? So, yeah, I thought it was interesting. I definitely think that there's still value in having someone with experience beyond you as an artist in, you know, kind of looking after the business side of things and kind of helping you to guide and manage your career. But I do think that these kind of services are interesting, and I think that artists and agents and, you know, gallerists and record label executives who might be able to combine the best of both worlds are going to be the most successful. So it was interesting to see, this kind of big disruption in music.
Yeah, look, I thought it was really interesting in terms of, you know, I mean, we were just talking this morning about a new platform that's kind of disrupting the illustration and design commissioning platform. And I think these things are happening more and more. And I think everyone, including, you know, our own business, you know, we're kind of nervous in or kind of waiting to see, you know, how tech is going to, you know, affect our kind of jobs. And, you know, I think that's exciting on one hand, it's terrifying on the other hand. But yeah, seeing it being done for the music industry in a new way. I mean, Apple's tried to do, you know, build in kind of this in some ways in Apple Music or even in iTunes previously and hasn't really worked. So yeah, we're definitely going to keep a close eye on that.
And I mean, it's backed as well by like Andreessen Horowitz and Floodgate and 20th Century Fox. And like, it's pretty major.
And I think one of the interesting things was like beyond kind of like working with musicians, like they also want to work with brands who are looking to advertise to specific segments of listeners, which I think is interesting as well. And, you know, I kind of like that Spotify, you know, my Spotify, like I like going to see music and I like that my Spotify is connected to platforms that, you know, share upcoming gigs with me. It's kind of like this sort of easy in, like I'm like, oh, I like that band. I listen to that band and I'm going to go watch them now because Spotify has told me that they're playing in a month's time in Brooklyn. So yeah, I think that's interesting.
Speaking of music and music acts and the future, tell us about Lil Miquela, Lara.
So like, I don't know if this is old news or new news or news at all, but this is new for me. And I thought it was so bizarre and so interesting at the same time relative to a lot of the things we've discussed on the podcast. So Miquela Sousa, who is better known by her artist name as Lil Miquela or simply just as Miquela, she is basically an Instagram model and music artist from Downey, California. And her Instagram account has like a ton of followers and she's very, very active and she posts pictures with all sorts of other celebrities and doing all these things and lots of sort of hashtag inspo stuff. But the thing that is interesting is that she's actually a computer generated sort of avatar. A pretty good one, right? I mean, she's not, a lot of people argue like, is she real? Is she not real? She's definitely not real. Like it's pretty clear that she is a 3D model, but it is still pretty amazing how she's managed to amass what is actually a very real following. And she's released actual songs with, you know, actual labels and she, you know, promotes actual products. And there's all this like insane conspiracy theories on the internet about who she is and why she exists and her agenda.
And where did you come across her again?
I came across her on Cool Freaks Wikipedia Club, which is just my favorite place on the internet. It's a Facebook group for people to find bizarre things on Wikipedia, basically. And they someone had just found this weird entry about Lil Miquela and posted it in there. But it's really fascinating because she sort of uses her platform as well to sort of support various socially minded causes like Black Lives Matter and various sort of Muslim and refugee advocacy organizations, transgender rights, the sort of protests against the Dakota Access Pipeline, all sorts of things. So, you know, but she's this sort of completely fabricated entity. And I think it's just really interesting, particularly with what we were talking about a few weeks ago when we were talking about social media influencers and influencer marketing and the issues behind, you know, whether someone is actually real. And I don't know if that actually matters if their engagement with their followers is real.
Yeah, no, it's really interesting. And also, I mean, we should put a link to the Cool Freaks Wikipedia.
Totally, we'll do.
Because yeah, that was the first time I heard of that and it is amazing.
Oh, it's the best.
And the third and last thing is a Chrome extension that we have been doing the rounds with called Inbox When Ready. Basically, it's something that lets you kind of set an inbox budget. It's a Chrome extension if you're using Gmail that lets you decide how many times you want to check your inbox, how much time you want to kind of spend on it. And then you kind of get some visual feedback about, you know, how you're doing versus kind of what your intention is. And yeah, this is a particularly tough one for me because I noticed that as soon as I turn my notifications off, it actually just encouraged me to check my emails even kind of more. But a few people have used it in the office. So yeah, we'll put the link to this in our show notes along with everything else like we do every week. You can sign up for our podcast specific newsletter at tinyletter.com/JackieWinter. If you want to get our links and all of our show notes emailed to you every week, along with a notification when the episode is ready. And with that, we will move on. Brendan Campbell has been involved in the Australian film and television industry since the mid-1980s. First starting out as a production runner and progressing through all the various assistant director roles, Brendan is now a very busy line producer. Through 25 years as a first assistant director, a large part of Brendan's working life has been spent on set, leading crews of 5 to 6 people through to a couple of hundred. He's been involved in some of Australia's most successful TV dramas, including Flying Doctors, Underbelly, and Nowhere Boys. And most recently, Brendan has worked on Barracuda, Glitch, and 7 Types of Ambiguity. He's also worked on feature films such as Ghost Rider, Ned Kelly, and The Chronicles of Narnia, and has a real wealth of experience and some great stories to share, and we're very excited to welcome him to the podcast. Brendan, thank you for coming on the show.
No problems. Glad to be here.
Excellent.
The first thing I want to say is my dad was an extra on Ghost Rider.
Oh.
And so potentially our lives crossed paths earlier than this. I think they contacted him. They needed some Mexicans for the background, and Dad, being the president of the Mexican Association of Victoria, got a random call one day and they said, can you get all of your buddies down to be extras in the movie?
I think I know the scene. Yeah.
Yes. I think he closes a garage door.
Yes.
It's a wonderful debut. Mm. But Brendan, look, thank you so, so much for joining us. We're super excited to ask you all manner of questions. But first, we're hoping you could just tell us a bit about your background and sort of how you got started in the industry.
How I got started in the industry is very, very old school. It was I'd worked in amateur theatre as a young kid, just backstage. I had a sister who has always worked in amateur theatre and been on the stage, and I was just the guy who owned the van who could help pick up things and move things.
Man with the van, yeah.
Exactly. And I kind of liked the world that it threw out there, and liked the people. And then as I got a little older, I'd worked in a couple of different roles. I'd been an apprentice spray painter, panel beater. I've worked in a bank. I've worked, done all of those sorts of jobs. But I ended up sharing a house with a friend of mine who worked at the ABC. And I just picked her brains and said, how do I go about getting in there? And did the usual thing that everyone does these days, except in the old days it wasn't via email. It was sit down and type out your desire to get into the industry and post a lot of letters to a lot of different production companies and so forth. And then I heard about a particular agent that found crew for shows. And so I got involved with them, and you paid them a monthly fee just to be on their books. I didn't get much out of that, but I did feel that I bought myself the right to call them every morning, every lunchtime, and close of business every day in order to find out what was going on.
So what kind of roles were you looking for at that time?
I was looking for just any driving, runners, any sort of entry-level jobs, just to work in the business, just to get an understanding of it and learn about it. And I ended up getting a couple of gigs on a couple of shows as a what they call a production runner, which is an entry-level position, and just ended up working on these shows. One of them was the very, very early incantation of the show Neighbours, and I was the production runner on the second season of that, which was because Neighbours started out on Channel 7, and they did one season, and then whoever it was there decided, no, that show will never last, and chopped it. And Channel 10 picked it up, and I worked for Grundy's, got a job working for Grundy's, who were the producers of Neighbours in those days, which Grundy's ended up turning into Fremantle Media. And produce it now.
So you didn't study anything in the area?
No, the opportunities to study in the industry, study for the industry were very, very limited back in those days, very limited. Like I left school, I hate to say it, in 1979, and the opportunity to go and study, there was Swinburne. I don't think the College of the Arts really had much at those stages, but it was also a very expensive thing to go and do because there was none of the computer technology and none of the digital technology that's available today. It was actually having the ability to go out and get some 16mm film and go out and create a story, shoot it, which was very, very hard to do back in those days compared to the availability of technology today.
So, totally. You're a production runner doing all sort of bits
started
and pieces.
As a production runner, yeah.
And then how did you move, say, up to that sort of middle stage of your career?
Well, people say the hardest thing is getting into it. I actually say the hardest thing now is getting out of it. it's a very difficult business to get out of. It's like a drug. You go from job to job. Every time you finish your job, you're looking for the next hit. But I got to know a few people as assistant directors. That seemed to be a role that I liked, and I thought, no, I can apply my skills to that. And I became a third assistant director on a couple of Australian miniseries and feature films in the mid-'80s, working under the tutelage of a first assistant director who is still out there today, operating a guy named Bob Donaldson, and I did a number of films with him and learned a great deal off him. And for over a few years, and then I got offered a role as a second assistant director. It's just working your way up through the ranks. You get a bit of experience, work your way up in the ranks, and then get a bit more experience, and then became a first assistant director, which to explain a first assistant director is you're the man that runs the floor, the actual set floor. You drive the ship. You're the floor manager, so to speak, but you schedule the film. You have a great deal of say in when and how and where things are going to be shot. I could sort of go through a whole spiel of the
It's an enormous amount of responsibility.
It is. It's an incredible amount of responsibility. But back in the late 80s and early 90s, it was a hell of a lot of fun too. I think I'm just very, very lucky to have met the right people and then just sort of guided myself. It is the industry that is, it's a self-promotion industry. The only way you're ever going to advance is you advance yourself and you take a punt on doing that. And sometimes when you make the transitions from one role to another, things might be a bit slow for a little while, but you've just got to be persistent.
And did you have a, you know, either formally or informally, a mentor of any sort, someone who guided you through things?
Not really, no. It was just a matter
Lone
of just,
Ranger.
Just kind of finding my way through. I worked under a number of different first assistant directors. I don't know if you've ever had a first assistant director on before.
We haven't.
It'd be really worth it to get one of the current guys on and have a chat to them, because the role is quite an amazing role, because you've got to actually run the ship, but you've also got to make sure that you still maintain the integrity of the story that you're trying to tell, but you've still got to get it done on time and on budget.
I'm curious about titles especially. I mean, always, because I mean, a lot of people that listen to this podcast, you know, might be coming from advertising background. They might know kind of some of the terminology around kind of, you know, film sets, and obviously it's also different from TV to film to advertising. And I always find that whenever I'm looking at the end or beginning kind of credit scene, Wikipedia is getting a real good workout, because I'm like, what does ASC stand for? What's a best boy? What's a gaffer? Like, what do these people do? And, you know, through learning that, that helps us as kind of creative producers, you know, set up some of the kind of more elaborate projects that we do, which still don't even touch the scale of what a actual live action production is. But I'm kind of curious, take me to the beginning in terms of what determines the structure of, like, how many, you know, directors you have, or how many kind of producers, you know, are on, like, who kind of, I guess, works out the whole human resource component of, you know, of a production at the beginning.
Well, that's interesting. It's a it varies from production to production. It can vary from a television show to a telemovie to a major feature film, and so forth. And it's really determined by the desires and ambitions and intent of the actual of the script. But effectively, what my role is these days is as a line producer with a great deal of first assistant directing experience, which the two go hand in hand. Is I can get a call from a producer now, and they will have a script, they'll be submitting for funding, and they need a budget and a shooting schedule done, and they come to me. And I get the script, I have a read of the script, I'll usually have a talk to the producer if they've engaged a director, try and engage in a conversation with the director as well, just to get an idea of the ambitions. And then I will put together, firstly, I'll put together a preliminary shooting schedule. That's determined, what determines the shooting schedule pretty much is the number of scenes, where they've got to be shot, actors, how many actors, actor availability, whether the scenes are to be shot at daytime, whether they're to be shot at nighttime, whether they're inside, whether they're outside, whether the sun's supposed to be shining or the sun's not shining. And a lot of that information ends up getting put into the schedule as the pre-production progresses. But initially, I'll try and put together a schedule. And then from that schedule, I will then generate what I perceive as a working budget. And then throwing that budget together, I then usually what happens is say, well, this movie is going to cost you this much. And I'll say, but I've only got that much. And then it's the whole exercise of, okay, modifying the ambitions in order to either get it down to a number or go and find the more money. Usually it's get it down to a number.
Yeah.
Yep.
Certainly is on our end as well.
Yeah. Some things don't change. The industries are the same all across. Yeah.
I mean, when you say line producer as well, like what is the line that you're producing?
It's got a number of different interpretations, and the title has sort of come about over the last few years. It's a bit of an American thing. There's a line and a budget that we have, and there's what we call above the line, which is where all producers, directors, key main cast are in, and they're all dealt with above the line. And then below the line is all the shooting crew, all the other cast, all the post-production, all the music, and all that sort of stuff. And it's kind of how it's sort of gauged. It can vary from show to show as to where that is and what that means. It does have an impact on how shows are funded, especially here in Australia, and can only claim a certain percentage of it to get qualified Australian production expenditure and so forth, which helps with the whole financing. I know I'm starting to talk.
No,
this is super interesting.
Well, but as far as a line producer is concerned, we had a beast called the production manager who manages the day-to-day of the office, which I'm sure you've all dealt with production managers. Line producer is probably just a step up above that with a little bit of creative input as well, where a production manager is predominantly more along the lines of the logistics, where a line producer does have a little bit of creative input and has a bit of a say in, or sometimes not, in assisting the producers at their level as well. Certainly not for me. I don't have anything to say much about the writing because I am in no way a writer and do never ever profess to be one or suggest that I have any ability there at all. But what I can do is I can sort of look at a script and I can look at a schedule and I can look at the logistics that are going on the day and say, okay, we're not going to make that day. We've got too much to shoot. The weather's closing in. Let's find a workaround. And we've got these elements available to us. So how can we make those elements work for us and still preserve the story?
I'm really curious when you are managing all of these different elements and, you know, you've got weather and you've got cast and availability and locations and all of that. How do you deal with continuity when you're shooting something over, you know, I mean, like what's the longest that you've shot one scene, like a couple of days or?
Oh, yeah, you can split a scene over a few days.
Yeah.
It's,
like a nightmare.
I had experience many, to explain an extremity of it, I was the first assistant director on one of the many units that was involved in shooting Return of the King over in New Zealand. And we were shooting additional footage at Return of the King, and this footage was tied into stuff that they'd shot 5 years earlier.
Oh my gosh.
Original Lord of the Rings shoot, and we were creating because that was just one big visual effects beast, that show. That was like layer upon layer. Every frame in that picture was probably about 10 different layers of image that created all those things. So I would say 5 years is probably about the longest the longest distance between scenes. Continuity is always going to be an issue. Weather continuity is always the biggest problem.
Well, because you can't control that.
No.
Yeah.
Unless you're a big budget picture and you can bring in the rain
machines
and all that sort of stuff, which doesn't really happen very often in Australia. On the big budget American movies, they do that.
I don't know. I was watching an American television show the other day, and I must admit, the snow effect out the window on Master of None was not great.
Yeah. I think we're also dealing these days is we've got an audience these days that are really well tuned to.
Everyone's a lot more savvy.
Oh, they are. When I think of the old days of when I was firsting on the floor of TV shows like The Flying Doctors, and someone would be fussing around with something in the background on the set and we're racing the clock, I'd say, come on, get off the set. It's only a 26-inch screen. that's kind of changed a little bit now.
Yeah, slightly.
And our attention to detail has to be a little bit more attuned now, and the audience is so much more savvy.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I'm interested in hearing as well a bit more about, like, because I mean, you've worked on so many different projects and in, you know, a variety of roles now, and you know, what are some key skills that you've picked up over the years that you think are sort of vital to making someone a good producer or a good first assistant director?
Always be willing to admit when you don't know something, and never bluff your way. Never try and bluff your way, because you will get found out very, very quickly. If you don't understand something, it's always best to just say, hey, I don't get that. Someone explain it to me.
Now, that is a lesson I think every producer learns the hard way.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you have any kind of stories to back that up at all? Like, have you ever seen it backfire?
I've seen it backfire a couple of times. To not major detriment, because you can usually sort of see it coming. I've seen a couple of producers try and bluff their way through things before, and I've had occasion where I said, oh, I don't know if that's really the right way to go. And for whatever reason, they've sort of taken my advice. But as far as people coming onto set with bad habits, I always sort of, when I see someone coming onto set for the first, well, not for the first time, but if they're a lot younger than me, which is most of the industry, these days, and they're doing something that I haven't sort of done, they're doing something in a way that I haven't done before, I try not to be that person that says, that's not the way we do it. I try to understand, okay, well, why are they attacking it this way? Is there a reason behind that? And maybe there's something there's always new stuff going on. And that's something I always say to people in this industry is, if you can never ever say you know everything in this business, because you can't. And it's changing all the time. It's ever evolving. The technology is changing. And it's something you've got to stay abreast of all the time. That's something I would say to anyone, is just try and stay abreast of the technology as it's coming up. It's you don't have to be an expert, but just be aware of what's happening out there technology-wise.
Absolutely. I guess being adaptable in that way is definitely another of those key skills that makes you a good producer.
Most definitely. You do have to be adaptable. You have to be aware of it. And there's new technology coming out now. Like, now the standard is being that we're going to be shooting everything 4K. The requirement is 4K. Delivery requirements are for 4K. Now, soon it'll be HDR 4K, and understanding that and what the implications are with all of that.
How do you keep abreast of that?
Usually you stumble across it, and when someone says something or you see something written, what the hell is that? And then you go, okay, what's this? And I try and find someone who I think may know the answer, and it's, okay, what's this all about? Why is this happening? Recently, most of the streaming networks, Netflix and Stan, they want to be able to broadcast all of their product in on 4K or 4K HDR, which will be the next big thing for them. Notwithstanding the 10% of the people that actually have the 4K televisions, that then the 10% of those 4K televisions that actually can broadcast HDR. But I think that's all about it. It's all about future-proofing themselves.
Yes, so that absolutely.
Keep on going. So, and that's just an example. It's just being aware of it. Like, I've transitioned from, we used to shoot series Australian television on 16mm film, and then we went to Super 16mm, and we thought we were pretty flash. And then we just started to shoot 35mm for series television, which we thought, it's a bit over the top and very expensive, because it was. Film is very expensive. And then suddenly this technology of the digital age came in. And I saw a few people sort of trying to cling to film and saying, no, this digital thing will never, we'll always shoot film. And sadly, they missed the boat. Rarely do you see anyone shooting any film. It's a bit of a mystery now to a lot of people to actually shoot on film. So it's, I suppose, you just got to stay abreast of the technology and be aware of it as it's advancing. And it'll keep advancing. It'll probably keep advancing to a level that one day where I'll say, no, I'll give up. Oh, I'm going to go retire.
Permanent holiday.
Yes.
Yeah. And what are some of the, what are some of the bigger day-to-day challenges that you face with your role?
From a day-to-day, it's really always the forward planning. You've just got to keep ahead of everything, keep abreast of everything, and anticipate. Just try and anticipate any issues or problems that may come up, and nip them in the bud before they do become an issue or a problem. And a lot of that just comes from having an understanding of the money, and having an understanding of the shoot, having an understanding of the story, and also understanding all the personalities that are around that.
That's a big part of production.
I mean, I want to dig into that a bit, because in a production you're dealing with so many creative people, like above the line and below the line, as you say, in terms of, and your job as a producer or director to get the best out of those people. And sometimes there is, you need the skills of, how do you schedule and budget for something like those hard skills and those softer skills, and like, how do you deal with a variety of different people and different needs and different kind of communication styles? So what separates a good producer from a great producer in that regard, or a great assistant director?
Certainly, as far as an assistant director is concerned, I think part of the skill of a good first assistant director is to be able to sort of walk that tightrope of between the creative and the logistics, and find that medium, and certainly make the creative feel that they're not compromising in order to achieve the logistics, but also the logistics not to be seen to be driving the creative. And it's really a fine line you've got to walk there. But it is personalities. It is, you've got to have a certain personality to be able to do it. I've seen some of the better and the best first ADs that I know and that I've worked with and worked under and also employed, people that really understand that, but they understand their logistics, but they don't lose sight of the end game. They don't lose sight of actually what you're trying to make, and it is a bit of a skill to be able to do that. Anyone can go and stand on set and bark orders and look at their watch all day and say, yeah, we've got to be done by 6 o'clock, so let's hurry up. But it's actually, and that's probably going through the head of every first AD, it's just how you express that and how you actually get everyone to work with you in order to achieve the best you possibly can with the resources. And that's one thing that we do well in Australia is our resources are usually fairly limited, whether they be fiscal or personnel-wise. But we do, and we're renowned worldwide for being able to make quality product with the resources that we have.
Yeah, I mean, I actually walked past a film set this morning here in New York, and there's always so many crew just standing around on set. I mean, how many people are you managing on set for, say, a film, like at any one time?
An average Aussie film or Aussie TV show is usually the on-set crews around about 50-odd people at any given point in time. But the unfortunate nature of how we make and just the labour-intensive nature of actually making television or film is that every person there, albeit when the general public walk past, they see a lot of people standing around, they're kind of waiting for their moment, and they have their moment to get in there and do their stuff. But then they've got to step out, and then they've got to get right away. And it is a bit of a, for the casual observer, it's like, it's almost like the road crews that are standing around leaning on their shovels, and you think, what are they all doing, all those guys? And I'm sure they have their moment to shine. It's so for Australian crews, yeah, 50 or 60 people for a standard Aussie TV show.
A lot of people
TV
to
show.
Be looking after.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. No, there's certainly quite a few there. When I worked on Narnia, I worked on the third Narnia up in Queensland. I ran what they called the second unit, and we were sort of shooting all the visual effects and so forth. I would go from a crew of 10 one day to a crew of 150 for the next day, subject to what our requirements were each day. And also from a cast, I might be dealing with one cast member, and then I'll be dealing with, you know, a couple of hundred extras and 10 cast members or 20 cast members in any given day. So it's always fluctuating. But the problem is that when it's always fluctuating, you still got to have those resources there to be able to service all of that. And you've got to be able to sort of expand and contract accordingly as is required.
Sounds sort of incredibly exciting and incredibly stressful at the same time.
Oh, yeah.
Which I imagine is kind of the kick you get out of it as well.
Well, it's as I sort of referred to earlier, it is kind of the drug. You finish a gig and it's like, oh, thank God that's over. But as you're sort of winding down one gig, you've been hustling and hustling elsewhere trying to line up the next job.
Yeah, totally.
How does that work? Like, it just seems like people just kind of find new things and they just kind of, it's a very organic process. Is that kind of how it is? Like, who people have in the Rolodex, or is it something a bit more formalized?
No, it's not formalized. It is kind of an organic process. It's certainly something that I think I managed to suss out very early in my career, having been freelance my entire career. It is a case of you've got to get to know people, you've got to get to know who's doing what, understand who the people are, who the movers and shakers are, who the people are that are doing things, and just be aware of what's going on and around you. And it is organic. I'll get a phone call, and I've had a couple in the last couple of weeks where I could have sort of jumped onto a number of different projects, but thankfully, for the one of the first time in my career, I'm saying, no, I need to stop. I've got to have a break. I can't. And it scares me to do it, but you've kind of got to be able to do that as well. But it is organic. It's once I get the job, if I'm engaged to start up a production, then I've got my crew, people that I engage, and I'm madly on the phone and hoping that they haven't picked up a job elsewhere. And if they have, well, good on them. But then I've got to find crew, and then I will work. Usually, when a producer has engaged me, they've already got a director on board. They've probably already been talking to a director of photography, and they've probably already got a production designer engaged, and they've been talking to them. And if that's the case, then I will then talk to each of those people about, okay, who do you want? And let's start the ball rolling. And
I guess everyone has their wish list of crew.
Absolutely, yeah. Everyone will have their favorite crew that they always want to work with, and you try and service that, because it's always best to get have everyone comfortable with the people they work with. Directors will have certain first assistant directors that they want to work with. Cinematographers will have entire camera departments and lighting departments and gripping departments that they will want to work with. And a production designer will have an art director and an entire art department team that they want to deal with as well. So you've just got to be on board with who they want and just start liaising with them. And then, then it's just this process. I start talking to everyone and voila, a couple of weeks later, there's a crew and we start shooting.
And what's your personal, like, you know, motivation, like in terms of, you know, a lot of people, especially I know from our role, like, you know, we're behind the scenes, you know, people don't know kind of our names or often, you know, kind of what we're doing, but we're, you know, vital to the process. And like, I would assume it can be even sometimes in such a large crew, you get even more kind of lost in the mix sometimes. I'm just curious, like where you come to it personally in terms of what gets you out of bed to do the work. And I know as well, like sometimes, especially in advertising, you can be working on, you know, clients or products that might not be the most, you know, exciting things, but yet there's something about the aspect of just helping other people or being of service that I know for me is motivating. But yeah, I'm curious how it can work when you're maybe working on something that's on a much larger scale.
As much as I'd like to be able to be in a position where I just sort of take on jobs that I'm personally invested in, it just doesn't work that way.
Sure.
Listen, there's a huge sense of achievement that you take out of a project from the moment you've sort of done day one to getting all the way through to delivery. The current project that I'm on at the moment, we're just winding it down. We deliver in a week or two, and that'll be on air. When I sit there and watch that on air, I'll say, "Wow, that was one wild ride we went on," and there it is. On air. I think it's just really the sense of achievement and the challenge. Every production is a challenge, and there's a huge challenge to sometimes it's a challenge to your own person in that I don't know if I'm going to be able to make it through this, but you get through it. And I've had those occasions, but you just sort of got to bite the bullet and just get to the end. Thankfully, I haven't walked off a job, and thankfully, hopefully, I never have to. It's the one beauty of the industry is that if you do have any personality clashes with people or anything like that, it's a short-term engagement. Yeah. The job will be over. You just put them on the list and you go, "Oh, I won't do that anymore," and walk away a wiser person.
Some of the, you know, biggest learning curves for us are when things do go wrong. And that's kind of, you know, then, you know, it sets up kind of process for us that they don't happen again. And we get better at doing that thing. I love hearing about disaster stories. Do you have anything in particular that you can flag that was a bit of a learning experience for you?
There's been a couple over the time. One is many years ago when I was a second assistant director, we were shooting a movie in Perth, and it was a film called Wind, and it was all about 12 meter yacht racing. And we were actually in 12-metre yachts filming. Filming on 12-metre yachts is just one of the most difficult things you could ever.
Oh, I mean, we all know that. We've all been there.
I liken it to sort of strapping a film crew to the back of a Formula One racing car and then sort of saying, "Let's go." We had a lot of expert sailors, a lot of former Australia 2 sailors and Kookaburra sailors and American sailors. We were shooting a lot of different races and different legs of races and so forth. And we had a safety team in boats outside. We, because of the nature of what we were doing, we'd had set up evacuation plans if ever there was an issue or anything like that. And as it turned out, we did have an accident one day. One of the yachts tacked across one of our safety boats, and the two safety guys actually went in the water and they got clipped by the wing keel of the yacht. And thankfully, a number of our sailors were also trained paramedics, and they were in the water straight away. They stabilized these guys. We had always had an evac plan, which had the guys going back into Perth, but not to our boat harbour, but straight up the Swan River to the base of where the Perth Hospital was. And then there was an ambulance there straight away, and they were taken straight in. Thankfully, we had that in plan, because they probably would have ended up a lot worse. One of the guys ended up, he lost his spleen, and the other guy lost his leg.
I don't even know what his spleen does.
Below his left knee, he ended up losing a leg.
So, oh my gosh.
It was a really, really scary thing, and it made everyone just sort of sit back and just assess exactly what we were doing, because guys, we're making a movie. How it ended up panning out in the work cover courts and ended up going to, I think, a US court. I won't go into all the details there because I don't know them all, but it was just a small oversight. But it was the sort of thing, no one had ever really made movies on the back of 12-metre yachts before. So it's not like there's a handbook that you can sort of pick up and through and check out. And that's one thing about filmmaking is there's lots of textbooks out there, but each story sort of presents its own little idiosyncrasies that we need to learn about. One great thing about the industry is that I've learned about so many other things because of the stories that we tell, and I've gone to some amazing places because of the stories that we tell. Having filmed in Perth, I've been to Cooper Pedy, I've been to Greece, I've filmed in Hawaii, I've filmed in Hong Kong, in Malaysia, and a lot of time in New Zealand as well. So
I went to Toowoomba for work a little while ago. That was pretty snazzy. Don't get too jealous.
No, I won't indeed.
It was wonderful.
It's obviously a very physical role. I mean, you're obviously spending a bit of time at your desk, doing like your initial budgets. But then when you actually get out onto a film set, you know, that's some very long days. Is there anything that you do outside of work that you kind of feel makes you a better producer and better at your job?
I surf.
You surf?
I surf.
Is that why you moved to Barwon?
You got to have something outside of the business. You really got to have some sort of escape, whether it be, you know, macrame my passion is surfing and also photography. And I've learned a lot of little tricks off a lot of the cinematographers I've worked with.
I can imagine. So iPhone shots are better than mine.
No, I'm still a hack amateur. So. Yes.
And this is, you know, a cliche question, but it's a cliche for a good reason, I think. What's the best or one of the better pieces of advice that you've received over the years? You must have worked with some amazing people.
Yeah. Very, very early, as soon as I started working this business, I worked with someone and they said, listen, you're going to – there's two pieces of advice. It's one is when you're working, you're going to get paid really well. Sock your money away and try and buy a house as soon as you can. And the other one was, you're going to get paid really, really well. Don't live like a rock star when you're paid like a rock star. Live like a pauper when you're paid like a rock star. And I think that's a really key thing that a lot of people need to know.
What if you're never paid like a rock star? What do you do then?
Then you'll know how to live like a pauper.
That's the next bit of the puzzle.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of things obviously have changed since those initial days. If there's people, who are interested in, you know, getting into the business or, you know, making a bit of a change, like, you know, what are the kind of pathways that exist now for people in production who might want to kind of, you know, step into film or start experimenting, seeing what it's like?
I'm truly an advocate of the way I did it and just try and get in at an entry level.
Possible today? Does that still work?
Yeah, it still works. Yeah, you can get in as a runner. And the skill set you need to have as a runner is have a personality, have an understanding of the clock, and have a driver's license. I still think whether it either be a runner or an art department runner or a production runner or a production assistant on an on-set production assistant, that role sort of exists on some of the larger budgeted shows. And it's really just a head down, ass up sort of attitude. You just got to keep just watch and learn, just watch, and the powers of observation can take you a long way and see how you go. But I know there's a lot of courses out there, and there's a lot of industry tertiary education courses out there that I must admit, when I get a CV in front of me, I'm more looking for who they've worked with and what they've done, especially at that entry level. So I hope no one from the tertiary education listening.
But we probably look at things similarly as well. Yeah. You know, I think that's probably – that holds true across a lot of industries and a lot of areas, particularly when what you're looking for is practical hands-on experience. Yeah. Honestly, this has been such a treat for us. We could pick your brains all day. But just before we wrap, you have had such a wealth of experience in the industry, and you are obviously very active in it currently, and you are about to take a break, but I'm, intrigued to know – whether there are any trends that you see coming up in the industry that you are excited about or not excited about, and how you see things evolving and shifting.
Certainly in Australia and Australian television, the days of the small independent producer, I think, are not numbered, but there's fewer of them, fewer and fewer of them around now.
And why is that?
Because the corporates are sort of taking over a lot of the smaller production companies. We've now got NBCU are here in Australia. We've got, I think Sony's taken over one of the smaller companies and so forth. So there seems to be less and less of the smaller independent producer. It's getting harder for an independent producer to sort of get out there and try and make a project without actually selling a kidney or selling his house or something like that. So whether that's a good thing or not, I kind of think it might be just the way the world's going now, because we do have the days of, certainly in a television world, the days of it just being 7, 9 and 10 and the ABC being and the SBS being our only sort of avenues for television viewing. Now we've got all the Netflixes, the Stans, and the Amazon's about to land and all those sorts of things. It's kind of broadened in a content sense, and I think a few of the corporates have sort of seen this could be good and have come in and grabbed some of the smaller companies and are making. They're satisfying a demand. There's a demand for content out there, and so that's what's happening.
Well, yeah, you and I were talking before the interview about how, you know, people are actually struggling to find crew because it's there's quite a huge demand for content, which is sort of a good problem for the industry, but it is making it difficult to produce stuff.
It will do. But again, the industry is cyclical. It really is. It will be very, very busy for the first half of next year, and then I can also see it coming to a screeching halt, and then suddenly people will be, this is where it comes to living like a rock star. You've got to learn to ride those cycles and so forth. So certainly the first half of next year I think is going to be very busy, and we're going to find it really challenging to just crew things up. But then once you get all of those people in and they think, oh, this is all pretty good, and then it all comes to a screeching halt, and then it's not so good anymore.
Much like the life of an artist, I think. I think some of our artists will understand that feeling.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Brendan, if people want to find out more about you or your work, do you keep any kind of social media presence or any kind of professional biography?
No, really only I'm on IMDb. I find that's the best way to sort of see what I've been doing and so forth. And that's really, really where I'm at.
Well, we will put a link to that on the episode. And it's fascinating to get this perspective from a completely different industry. And just wanted to thank you for coming by and sharing with us.
No worries.
Thank you so much, Brendan.
I hope it's been helpful.
Closing like we try to do every week is the most Melbourne and the most New York thing.
Yeah, I've got a Sydney thing this week purely because it's it's an Australian thing. This is like such a deeply Australian story. There was yet another guy who was attacked by a shark, and he defended himself by punching the shark in the face. And he was inspired by Mick Fanning, who did that, you know, so nonchalantly however long ago. But again, just like so casually was like, oh, yeah, this shark was coming at me. And I thought, oh, just punch it in the face. And the shark went away. And he's basically just got like, he's got a few little puncture marks and a few scratches. But otherwise, he's A-okay.
What?
B.
Well, mine's kind of.
Pixar didn't happen. That's just kind of what I'm saying.
Pics are literally right here.
Wait, let me see.
Oh, of the punching?
Yeah
I don't have pics of the punching. Who's going to take their phone out? I'm actually probably all millennials. But yeah, it's pretty crazy.
Body cams. B.
I guess mine's more of an American thing, but I went to a sports bar recently to, you know, eat disgusting nachos with the god-awful but kind of great, like, fluorescent orange liquid cheese and watch the football. But I mean, I'm not a sports fan, and I kind of didn't realize how big sport was here until we went into the bar and the host who was seating us, you know, asked us which game we were there to see so she could sit us in front of the right television, because there was like 100 televisions all playing different games that were happening simultaneously. I did not realize that
Bianca, Jeremy and I are just shaking our heads at each other.
Well, I guess I forgot that there's more like
yet again living under a rock.
52 states here, but yeah, it was a lot.
Well, actually, I do have a Melbourne thing.
Did you Google it right now?
No, I didn't Google it. But the other day I went to my first NGV opening at the National Gallery of Victoria. Because
your first NGV opening?
How is this
ever
possible?
Like, proper one. Yeah, I know. I was on a list on an iPad and everything. I felt very fancy. But one of our artists, Clemens Hebeck, his wife/partner, Mel O'Callaghan, has a stunning video work there, which actually features Clemens himself. Anyway, I mean, the NGV, like this, the part of this opening was an amazing show. There's four female artists that are kind of taking the whole top floor, including Helen Maudsley, Del Catherine Barton. And my favorite show, I think not only one of the best shows I've kind of ever seen, it's from an artist named Louise Paramore, who does these amazing brightly colored sculptures of all kind of found objects, like all kind of plastic pieces that she kind of puts together into sculptures. And yeah, it was just, I mean, it was for someone who doesn't get out enough at the moment, like it was just an amazing experience. But yet to see the NGV's programming here, so it's a very Melbourne thing. If you are in Melbourne, I would definitely suggest getting out to checking those shows out. That's all I got.
Amazing.
That's enough.
Thank you, B.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lara.
Thank you. Go.
This has been Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. Jackie Winter Gives You the Business is a weekly podcast about creative project management and production and just making things happen in general. Our producer is Areej Noor. You can find the Jackie Winter Group on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Jackie Winter. That's Jackie with a Y and Winter like the season. And you can email us with any recommendations, feedback, questions, or comments at podcast@jackiewinter.com. We really want to hear some suggestions and of other people to interview. So yeah, if anyone comes to mind, please drop us a line. Archives of all of our shows and show notes can be found at jackiewinter.givesyouthe.biz. And you can also sign up to our podcast specific newsletter at tinyletter.com/Jackie Winter. Our theme music is by Melbourne based musician Jackie Winter. You can check out his stuff on soundcloud.com/Jackie Winter. If you love what you hear, you can help us out by subscribing on iTunes, rating us, and commenting too. Details are on our website at jackiewinter.givesyouthe.biz. Thanks for listening. Catch you next week. Bye bye. Yeah. She thinks I'm in-